someone the NSA once listed as the most dangerous hacker in America. Sure don't look like much.
He travels the world and scans the web to keep you up to date on the latest threats to the internet and to your cybersecurity. He brings you the latest on the fight against cyberterrorism, keeping you safe with the best cybersecurity information on the radio. It's Cybersecurity Today with John Bambanek.
Good morning. You've tuned into Cybersecurity Today Radio with your host, John Bambanek. Broadcasting on AM 820 News covering Tampa Bay and the West Coast, as well as AM 1060 News covering the Space Coast and Orlando. You can find our podcast online with whatever podcast software you use. Just search for Cybersecurity Today Radio. You can connect with us on our website, cybersecuritytodayradio.com, on Facebook and Twitter at CyberSec Radio. My personal Twitter account is at Bambanek, B-A-M-B-E-N-E-K. And by email, johnbambanekradio@gmail.com, J-O-H-N-B-A-M-B-E-N-E-K, radio@gmail.com. A lot of great content we're talking about today on cybersecurity, so we will just jump right into it. So pretty full agenda. The first is news towards the end of this current week that there was six countries involved in taking down a dark web, what we call a dark web marketplace. And that is, in essence, what is think the black market in the online world called Alphabet. You can buy drugs on it, guns, human trafficking, all sorts of criminal transactions happen there. You know, credit card, stolen credit cards, so on and so forth. So a few dozen of these criminal marketplaces exist using a wide variety of techniques to hide themselves. But eventually, law enforcement caught up to the operator behind this, a Canadian-born individual who lived in Thailand, had millions of dollars, actually owned a Thai hotel from his ill-gotten gains, and heard that he had committed suicide in a Thai prison when police caught up with him. So a very big arrest in one of these black market cyber criminal bazaars, in essence. So it's really big news for people in my world. At the same time, or a similar time frame, Dutch authorities took over a similar marketplace called Hansa. And when Alphabet went offline, it's actually been offline for a few weeks. We knew something was up, but now it's been announced exactly what happened. A lot of Alphabet users went to Hansa that was taken over by Dutch authorities, and it allowed the police basically to see their transactions, who's buying drugs online, who's involved in human trafficking, selling malware. A lot of these criminals, you know, that we see the evidence of their behavior but have a difficult time actually penetrating and getting visibility into who's doing business with who. So a lot of great information was gleaned from that way. There are some people kind of grousing that the Dutch police were running a criminal forum for a month. It looks like they had whatever judicial sanction they needed in the Netherlands to do it. And as I said, it's all fair in love and war, right? If you're a criminal, well, you know, the police are going to pay attention and use and be aggressive in going after you. So it's a very interesting chain of events. Alphabet going down, those users going to Hansa, which was operated at that point by law enforcement, and then using all of that information to create a whole bunch of leads. They were saying something like about 10,000 different people may have been identified in transactions on Hansa. So a lot of arrests will probably be coming in the future from this. So certainly stay tuned for that. It's big news. There isn't often that there's arrests at that level of people who are doing this. But, you know, when it happens, you know, it's always big news. The attorney general was out there at a press conference later in the week. You're listening to Cybersecurity Today Radio with your host, John Bambanek. So in other news this coming up week, a lot of interesting reports coming out. We saw a little bit about this last week. Again, this week that power suppliers and utilities in Britain were hacked, and that was were attributed to likely being Russian criminals during the general election in the UK. The UK had elections in early June. I was in London for that when that happened. It didn't seem like there was a lot of election-related hacking of the kind that we saw in the United States. But certainly, you know, there was attacks going on. And now that we're getting some more information about that, the British spy agency GCHQ said that their infrastructure systems in the UK were compromised superficially anyway by people they attribute as likely being Russian state-backed individuals. So certainly a lot of more information, right, pointing the finger at Russia and Russian hacking, which, you know, we've come to time and again, and I'm sure we're going to talk about more. But a lot of concern about their power grid, power systems. This is coming to the fore again. In Ukraine, for instance, Russia's been blamed for actually causing power outages and power companies in Kiev and elsewhere. That hasn't really happened in you know, quote, first world countries like the U.S. or U.K. But there have been a lot of probes, compromising of systems of these companies, usually office systems. So, you know, like any company, right, that a power company is no different. There's people sitting in a cube whose job is to deal with Excel spreadsheets or post to Facebook or whatever. So it's usually those kind of computers, not necessarily the power grid itself. But there is a lot of attention and escalation on infrastructure-related security concerns. So we're going to hear a lot more about this. There is certainly a lot of conversation about what this means under international law if another country hacks another country, victim country's power grid. You know, is that a violation of international law? You know, what kind of repercussions take place, so on and so forth. So a lot of conversation of that sort is taking place, and certainly this leads to conversations in cybersecurity norms, you know, how nations should interact with others in cyberspace, and you know, what this means for foreign policy going forward. After the break, we're going to talk a little bit about what the State Department is doing and making changes to how they handle cyber issues. So directly, you know, an input to what we're talking about here, you know, does the State Department take a strong stand and take steps to deal with these probing attacks on our power companies? And, of course, the UK, what are they going to do about this going forward? So stay tuned for that with our digital partner, cyberscoop.com, after the break here. So it's not often, kind of going back to this report out of the UK, not very often, except in the last 12 to 16 months, where spy agencies are explicitly pointing the finger at Russia in this way. In the past, these kind of things have happened in the past. It's not new information per se, but the vigor and volume of actually naming, I would say naming and shame, but you can't shame somebody who doesn't really care if you know, of the adversary about this. So certainly, it's going into a lot of the fervor, a lot of the conversation we've been having about Russia. And it's a reminder that our power companies, our power grid, are relying on systems that never really were designed for the internet and, you know, are being put on the network, or the machines that control them are being put on networks. And they're vulnerable to a lot of relatively easy exploits that people are looking to exploit, right? I tell people I'm actually a little bit less concerned about Russia hacking our power grid, because at a certain point, you know, there's consequences they don't want to deal with, you know. But North Korea, Iran, pariah countries, if they get in, they don't really care, or hacktivists who just want to create chaos. If Russia can do this, others can as well. So certainly a lot of work needs to be done there. A lot of people have spent the last few years trying to solve this problem. We're getting there, but we're not quite there yet. So, you know, stay tuned for more. Pay attention to this issue, you know, as it'll ramp up. I'm sure we'll see more stories here in the coming weeks. So we're going to take a short break here and bring on our guest. So stay tuned. You are listening to Cybersecurity Today Radio with your host, John Bambanek, and we will be right back.
This is Cybersecurity Today with John Bambanek. This is Cybersecurity Today with John Bambanek.
And welcome back. You're listening to Cybersecurity Today Radio with your host, John Bambanek. Joining me now is Patrick O'Neill from CyberScoop, our digital partner. You can find them online at cyberscoop.com, and some of our podcasts are up on their website, too. So thank you for joining us today, Patrick.
Thank you for having me, as always.
All right. So let's jump right into it. Some big changes being indicated this week anyway. I think the only thing we know for sure is the first cybersecurity coordinator, in essence at the diplomatic rank under ambassador, but pretty high-ranking State Department official for cybersecurity issues, was announced that he was leaving his post by the end of this month. And that there might be potential reorganization in how the State Department handles these issues. So why don't you go and tell us, what do we know so far?
Well, I think you set that up perfectly, because there's a lot we don't know. What we do know is that Chris Painter is leaving the State Department. He's leaving his role as the top cyber diplomat for the U.S. There have been reports following that initial report saying that the entire department underneath him is being downsized. Now, you have to follow that with some of the open questions. What does that mean for our foreign policy as far as cyber? What does that mean for the department? What does that mean for other departments in terms of where those responsibilities go, who carries them out? And then what does that mean for Chris Painter, who apparently is going to be headed to the DOJ, is the latest report, back to the DOJ, which is where he was earlier in his career, after some personal time when he leaves on July 31st. So there's a lot of questions. And then, you know, there's obviously the question of timing, right? I think that really on any level you look at it in terms of international relations with the U.S., cyber is at or near the top of the priority list. So how does this make sense? And when you ask that question, the answers are limited or silent, right? There hasn't been much in by way of explanation. And so, yeah, you know, more questions than answers at this point, big questions though. And it's kind of shocked me how little attention this has gotten on even a national level. You know, this seems maybe like a wonky position, but it's incredibly important. Chris Painter has impact on headline news on important international affairs. So I think you'll see this kind of creep more into the mainstream questions and news as time goes on.
Well, no, I certainly think so. It's one of these roles that, you know, exists. There's a lot of work that needs to be done at a diplomatic level. Just this week, there was an international cooperation for the prosecution of people behind Alphabay, which, right. You know, a lot of people focus on law enforcement, but it is enabled by the State Department, because anytime countries have to cooperate, well, they go through the State Department or whatever foreign affairs department in a foreign country. So one of the interesting things that I took note of, all right, Obama, prior to his leaving last year, set up a cybersecurity commission. What more can we do? And suggested that this coordinator for cyber issues should be made an ambassador at large, right, of which we have six. Four of those six are vacant, right? So certainly it seems that, you know, assuming the stories are true and some of the indications from the State Department that are getting that's going to be downsized, the office will be downsized or eliminated and rolled into a business affairs office. I forget exactly which one, business and trade policy or something along those lines, certainly seems to be taking it in a different direction.
That's right. And I mean, you pointed out a great specific example, right? So Alphabay, it's a major darknet market, that was making millions and millions of dollars, and a multinational law enforcement and intelligence operation ended up bringing it down, it was announced today, several other markets down, and there are a bunch of arrests that have been made. And that is exactly enabled by guys like Painter and the people in his orbit. You know, there was, I think, within the last month, a partnership announced with Israel in terms of in the cyber domain. Obviously, there's a lot of work with Europe going on in that domain. And this all crosses into Chris Painter's world and that area of State Department. So the question is, what's the future there?
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly it, right? More questions than answers, and, you know, and it's certainly a very relevant post. You know, organizations could go good or bad. You know, it may be they're putting the issue on the top of the agenda. It may be they're ignoring it completely. Who knows? Time will tell. You also had another story up this week. Senator Ron Wyden sending an email to the Department of Homeland Security about email security for the U.S. federal government. You know, walk us through what that is. I mean, I know what DMARC is, but in a digestible form, if you can, exactly what Senator Wyden was asking for.
Yeah, so I think the easiest way, the bite-sized version of this, is that DMARC is about email integrity. It's about anti-phishing. It's about it's anti-impersonation technology, which, you know, when you think about it and you think about how it's an industry standard, you see this in the private sector. The fact that it hasn't made its way across federal agencies is for people in that world. Well, I guess it depends how you look at it, but it's something that needs to have happened yesterday, and mm-hmm. Wyden is pushing for it to happen now. And it's part of a wider push, I think, kind of to understand what's going on, at least out of Wyden's office. He's really been sending these letters over the last year, especially in 2017, getting into certain cybersecurity issues on a relatively granular level. You don't see letters coming out of a senator's office saying, we need two-factor authentication, mm-hmm. we need DMARC, we need STAR TLS, email encryption. And that's what we're seeing.
We need actual smart cards and not ID cards that just have the picture of a smart card on it.
Right. I mean, listen, it's a low bar, but he's jumping over it in terms of getting into these somewhat obvious, you know, nonpartisan issues of security in the federal government. And the reason he's doing that now is because he's employing Chris Segoyan, who was a ACLU technologist for 4 years. I think it's just important to point out the pivotal role. Chris is the driving force behind these mm-hmm. letters. There's no doubt about it. These are issues that he has brought up for years before going into government.
Right, right.
And he's able to bring to bear a technical education that is extremely rare in congressional offices. So, you know, the reaction, just speaking broadly about what's come out of Wyden's office on this stuff over the last year, has been mixed. You know, the Pentagon adopted better email encryption, mm-hmm. but there's been other things that have been resisted or not acted on. So, you know, we'll see what happens in terms of DMARC. It seems like a no-brainer, but it's the federal government, so we'll
all right.
Stay tuned.
Yeah, I mean, the basic upshot, right? This is a very basic step, right? That you know, security 101 thing that prevents people from sending email that looks like it's coming from a government address, right? You know, so you couldn't send
exactly.
an email at ron.wyden@mail.senate.gov or whatever his email address actually is, right? So very basic.
Or out of
stuff.
The IRS, you know, there are these massive phishing campaigns going on out of, or rather impersonating government agencies that make a ton of money and are very common mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. should be probably, you know, prevented, fought against. So
absolutely.
This would help in a lot of that stuff.
Absolutely. So running up to a hard stop here. Once again, thank you, Patrick O'Neill, Cyberscoop.com, our digital partner, for joining us. Stay tuned. We have more coming up after the break. You're listening to Cybersecurity Radio with John Bambanek, and we'll be right back after this short break.
Scan your computer, but don't scan the dial. Stay right here. John Bambanek will be right back. This is Cybersecurity Today with John Bambanek.
And welcome back. You're listening to Cybersecurity Today Radio with your host, John Bambanek. A couple more interesting stories wanted to bring to your attention. Ship hacking, and by ship I mean actual ocean-faring sea vessels. A lot of interesting research discovered by basically hacking into ships via their satellite GPS transponders. So a lot of, you know, big companies, big shipping companies want to keep track of their boats, you know, ship things all over the globe. And actually, there's websites you can look, ship trackers, to see where ships are on the seas, right? All these things communicate by satellite because other forms of communication aren't exactly going to be entirely successful. So they transmit some information by satellite to, you know, some central office somewhere. A lot of very important navigational uses for it. So researchers started taking a look at that and saying, hey, you know, can I get into this? Can I, you know, brick or otherwise make completely inoperable the ship's navigation? Are there things that I can do? And found out, again, the usual story here is that the people who made these systems never really thought to consider security issues, right? This is, well, this is satellite navigation for, you know, big ocean vessels. Who's going to sit there and want to hack a container ship? But there's a lot of people out there, you know, who, I don't know, benevolent or for curiosity or whatever reasons, are always trying to find new and novel ways to get into things, what they can access, how they can access, and not necessarily do harm, but figure out exactly what kind of harm they could cause. So a lot of this was done by anonymous researchers, posting on Twitter and the like, giving some information to the media of what could be done. So one of these things was this ship tracking map that's credited to Jeff Merrick. You can see it at shiptracker.showdown.io, which basically uses some of this information to get GPS position and some of the data on it, because these things are essentially being put on the internet via satellite connection, but they have dashboards with a lot of information, right? You know, where the vessel is heading, what direction, its position, what frequencies it's using, a little bit about the equipment that's on it. So, you know, as we're talking, I'm looking actually at one of the tracking dashboards that was published online on the internet. So, you know, you see a lot of very interesting data points in there. And if you can get to this administrative panel, you know, it kind of begs the question of what else could you get into? So, but generally just badly configured device, no real access control. Nobody really thought that this stuff would be accessible on the internet, but here you are, and Shodan can find it. I did want to take a specific mention about Shodan specifically. It's a service, Shodan.io. It's scanning the entire internet all the time for things that can be accessed without authentication. So you could see webcams that are on the internet, don't have access control, which means you can see what that webcam can see anywhere in the world. That was kind of the first use of this stuff. And Shodan has a variety of research uses. I don't want to say it's wouldn't classify it as a tool commonly used by criminals. It's more used by researchers and the academic community. But it finds all sorts of things because it's constantly scanning the internet. The criminals are, too. They have their own tools, which means if you unknowingly plug something into the internet and it's accessible to the internet and has a web server listening or some vulnerable piece of software or the tracking system and administrative interface for an ocean-faring vessel, there are services out there that can find it relatively easy. So, you know, for those technically inclined, take a look at Shodan.io, Shodan.io. There's a lot of pre-built searches in there, but, I mean, you could look for keywords, any number of things. And you could find all sorts of interesting things out there. I've used it to find criminals, command and control servers, you know, a little bit about finding, you know, where they're hiding. Certainly, researchers have found open and insecure services. We've heard a lot about, I know I've talked on the show last couple of times about people having cloud storage on the internet with no real access control. So this is something researchers can do to just find interesting stuff listening on the internet that never should have been listening in the first place. And we keep running into this problem is that people take normal stuff and put it on the internet and think, oh, everything's okay. The reality is that it's a different risk model, and you have to consider issues that most people have never thought of before, and they lead to these kind of issues. So certainly very interesting. You know, if you want to geek out, go find a webcam in another country, see what's going on there. Go on to Shodan.io and see what you can find. And if you find anything interesting, write in. We'll talk about it on the air. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Cybersecurity Today Radio with your host, John Bambanek. The other story that I wanted to bring out, right, a flaw in a home security system and some other, again, embedded devices or Internet of Things is making the rounds lately. One such vulnerability is called Devil's Ivy. Most of these Internet of Things developers, or for that matter, software generally, relies on a lot of third-party tools and products. So Devil's Ivy, somebody was testing this security tool, found a vulnerability. Well, the vulnerability wasn't in their code. It was in code from somebody else that they used, something called GSOAP. And turned out it's being used by 34 different companies in millions of devices all over the place because, you know, some developer, some company said, hey, this library, this tool does what I need it to do. I'll just add in the pieces I need on top of that, and we'll go from there. And it leads to all sorts of interesting issues because, you know, most people think, oh, I've got to update my code. I got to keep it up to date. I know it. But a lot of people tend to neglect the code and the software they borrow from others. So those gets neglected. It leads to a lot of these vulnerable devices being out on the Internet, being accessible to things like Shodan, and potentially compromising your security. The patch for that vulnerability has been out a month. But, you know, I'm sure you may have Internet of Things devices at home, some connected treadmill, a connected smart TV. Take time to think, you know, when's the last time you applied an update? You know, gone into the settings or however you do it and say, hey, download new firmware. I'm going to bet most people listening haven't. I don't do it regularly, and I know this stuff because, you know, it's kind of a pain. It takes time out of a busy day. I know I've got five kids. Most of these devices are not set to automatically update. You've really got to take steps to being aware, you know, if there's security issues with your device and then proactively applying security updates to it. There's nobody else that can do it for you. There's no automatic update. It's not like your Windows 10 laptop that says, oh, by the way, I need to apply updates. Should I reboot now? Nothing like that for Internet of Things. And until that's changed, until there's, you know, a real automatic update kind of system to harden these devices, we're going to keep seeing stories like ocean-faring ships being found on the Internet and being able to track it, and all these Internet of Things devices. So, you know, certainly keep that in mind. Take a look at some of those issues as you buy connected devices and be aware of what the risks are, and especially learn how to update them, keep them up to date so that you're not vulnerable to security updates or security vulnerabilities when those are found. If you'd like to connect with us, visit our website, cybersecuritytodayradio.com, at Facebook and Twitter, at CyberSec Radio, or my personal Twitter account, at Bambanek, B-A-M-B-E-N-E-K. You can email us, J-O-H-N-B-A-M-B-E-N-E-K, radio@gmail.com, for questions you want to hear us address on the air. Again, thanks to our digital partner, cyberscoop.com, has great cybersecurity news to keep you informed throughout the week. And to our radio affiliates, AM 820 News covering Tampa Bay and the West Coast, as well as AM 1060 News covering the Space Coast and Orlando. If you'd like to connect with us, potentially be a sponsor of the show, drop us an email, connect with us online to get out your cybersecurity or IT service. So we're going to take a quick break right here, but we're going to be right back for another interview. So stay tuned. You're listening to Cybersecurity Today Radio with your host, John Bambanek.
This is Cybersecurity Today with John Bambanek. Bambanek's back with the latest on cybersecurity.
And welcome back. You've tuned into Cybersecurity Today Radio with your host, John Bambanek. Next up, we have Robin Burke joining us, author of an upcoming book, We Don't Have to Collapse, But We Could. how to fix the complex systems we rely on. She's formerly with the Defense Threat Reduction Agency doing interdependent network research, as an expert on network science, a lot of experience doing technical stuff. So wanted to bring her on, talking about the dangers of a cyber attack. You know, it's a topic we've talked about on the show a couple of times, and what you need to know. Thank you for joining us today, Robin.
Thank you for having me, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks. So let's get right into it, right? Society has a lot of complex systems, you know, and many of it's networked, connected to the internet. Most of it is transparent to us as users. You know, we would look at it and never quite know.
Yes.
But it's all vulnerable. You know, we talked in the last segment about finding ocean-faring ships on Shodan and accessing its GPS transceivers. How do we fix this problem that we keep running into, you know, time and time again?
Well, I think we fix it long-term the way software fixed the problems with the waterfall development model.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that a long time ago, people in the Western tradition urged principles like subsidiarity,
mm-hmm.
which comes out of the theology area. But what it comes down to is the idea that what makes our large complex systems vulnerable is precisely their interdependence. And the more that we attempt to control them from some centralized point and to make them highly efficient, the more we introduce the likelihood of problems. So if I may, I'll tell you a brief story about how that was discovered.
Sure.
When I was at DITRA, I was running this research grant program. DITRA doesn't do much in the way of basic research because that's not its job. But when you have a mission critical need, people's lives are at stake and there are no tools, you've got to get somebody to figure out how to make tools. So we did this research grant program in this emerging new discipline called network science, which is the mathematics of how complex adaptive network systems work, what makes them fragile, what makes them surprisingly robust sometimes. And I kicked off a grant with two very senior researchers. They're quite well known in the physics world. And I asked them, you know, you're looking at, you're addressing a research problem regarding how a failure in a network like the internet or the power grid would cascade, would cause like an avalanche of successive failures. And we're familiar with this with denial of service attacks, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You can cause an avalanche of timeouts across the whole internet if you do enough denial of service work. So I asked of these physicists, Gene Stanley and Shlomo Havlin, I said, you know, if you get a chance during your research, would you please address whether your research results on this would change in the event that the network we're talking about isn't standing alone, but is connected to other networks, like the power grid and the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Because up until then, the network science that had been done on standalone models of networks. You know, they have nodes, they have connections, what kinds of things make them strong, what make them weak. And these researchers, being extremely good and very senior in the field, 3 months later had an article accepted at Nature, which is pretty breathtaking. And here's what it came down to. They had access to data from a major power and internet blackout that swept across Italy in less than 24 hours, right after, just a few days after the Allies entered Iraq in 2003. And of course, everybody says this has got to be some sort of sabotage or terror. Nobody could find any evidence for that.
Mm.
And they looked. So Shlomo Havlin and Gene Stanley went back and looked at the data again.
Mm-hmm.
And they found something really interesting. There was this relatively unimportant, you know, out in the countryside power plant, just happened to be the power source for an internet routing node. It wasn't a major node. It wasn't Rome. except that most of the SCADA systems, most of the system control and data acquisition commands to other power plants in that region of Italy flowed through that internet node. Can you see what's going to happen?
Yeah.
Right? And that's actually what swept across the country. And Gene Stanley referred to it as the surprising fragility of interdependence. And so one of the ways that we get around this problem is to not have single interdependences like that. For those of our listeners who want to read a little bit more about that work, Wired Magazine had an article, trying to remember which year, but if you Google mathematics prevent network failure and Wired, it was in Wired Magazine, you pull up the article. I'm quoted at the end in it. All but one of the researchers that is interviewed in that article was funded at least in part by my program, and that Italian blackout is the lead story in the article.
No, it's a very interesting story, and it kind of reminds me of an anecdote that I know kind of the more cynical and dark people in cybersecurity will use, right? You know, that it's all so brittle. You know, we're not surprised that people break into it or that it breaks. We're surprised that it actually works in the first place.
Well, and you know, the interesting thing about all of that, it goes back to the heart of TCP/IP, right? The original design of the internet was to allow military communications in the event that there was a nuclear attack on continental United States and power and telephone lines were cut. And so it's an intentionally inefficient, redundant system, but its original design is much more vulnerable than the OSI stack model. And the reason that's true is that the assumption was that this was a closed system.
Right.
You know, and when it went from ARPANET to the internet and then went international, but we were still stuck with TCP/IP. Well, first of all, I mean, that was great. It got us PCs quickly. It got us the internet.
You know, a lot of great information. But really, the book she's talking about is answering the questions, okay, what to do about this? We all kind of know what the problem is. It may be not to a great technical detail, but we know bad things can happen. You know, but the question is, what's then, how to plan for it, you know, to prepare for it, and what we can do to prevent it. So a lot of great information there. So look forward to reading those when they come out also. So thank you for joining us, Robin.
My pleasure, John. Take care.
All right, you too. Again, that was Robin Burke, author of an upcoming book, We Don't Have to Collapse, But We Could, How to Fix the Complex Systems We Rely on. So some good information there. Certainly check Amazon. Get some use out of your Amazon Prime Prime account to get those books. Coming to the end of our show here, broadcasting on AM 820 News covering Tampa Bay and the West Coast, as well as AM 1060 News covering the Space Coast in Orlando. You can find us online, cybersecuritytodayradio.com. Podcast of the show, just search with your favorite podcast software, Cybersecurity Today. That brings us to the end of our show today. Hope you enjoyed listening. If you'd like to connect with us, visit our website, cybersecuritytodayradio.com, at Facebook and Twitter, at CyberSec Radio, or my personal Twitter account, at Bambenek, B-A-M-B-E-N-E-K. You can email us, J-O-H-N-B-A-M-B-E-N-E-K, radio@gmail.com, for questions you want to hear us address on the air. Again, thanks to our digital partner, cyberscoop.com, has great cybersecurity news to keep you informed throughout the week, and to our radio affiliates, AM 820 News covering Tampa Bay and the West Coast, as well as AM 1060 News covering the Space Coast and Orlando. If you'd like to connect with us, potentially be a sponsor of the show, drop us an email, connect with us online to get out your cybersecurity or IT service. Thank you for tuning into Cybersecurity Today Radio with your host, John Bambenek. Enjoy the rest of your weekend and catch you next week at the same time. I guess I didn't know.